This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Clive Barker burst on the horror scene in 1985 with his collection of short stories, Books of Blood. He cemented his reputation in the years that followed with horror and fantasy novels and with the films Hellraiser and Candyman and their sequels. His career stopped dead in its tracks in 2012 after a visit to his dentist's office resulted in a coma. While he recovered and is still alive, no new books have been published since a novella, Chilliad, A Meditation, came out in a limited edition in 2014. The Probabilities crew, Richard A. Lupoff, Lawrence Davidson, and I, we interviewed Clive three times. The first interview, conducted in the KPFA studios in September 1987, was digitized and uploaded to Radio Walensky in October 2022. The second interview was recorded on October 21st, 1988, in front of a small audience at Dark Carnival Bookstore in Berkeley. Clive was in town to promote Hellraiser 2, and the interview, which feels more like a modern-day podcast, focuses on his troubles avoiding an X rating for his film, along with discussing his most recent work, Cabal, which featured a novella of the same name, plus a handful of short stories. This interview was digitized and lightly edited October 25th and 26th, 2025, and has not been heard in over 30 years. The third interview with Clive Barker from 1992 has yet to be digitized.
You were with us a year ago at the time that Hellraiser 1 came out. And now there's a sequel. Can you talk about that for a second?
Sure. Well, I didn't direct the sequel. I executive produced. It's my story, I guess, as well. What had happened was that the first picture... I had the first picture actually come out when we last spoke, just, right? It ended up making a lot of money for New World and did a lot of business on video and sold well around the world. The Japanese were particularly keen on it. And, in fact, they wanted some of the stuff the MPA had taken out, put back into their version of the movie so they could actually see the 35 seconds of mayhem which had been removed. They made a bunch of money from it, and so they came back to us and said, you know, we want a sequel, and we're going to make it with or without you, which was not great news, because I had seen sequels. I guess the really bad sequel for me is always Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which undercut all the good stuff that had been done by Wes Craven in the first picture, you know, made a comedy of something, which I really liked the first picture, and I really hated the second. I think that's pretty much a universal opinion. And I didn't want them to do that. I didn't want them to sort of turn it into sort of the Lucy Show or something with Cenobites, which they are capable of, you know. And they also have something of a TNA reputation. I was afraid they'd do that as well. And we'd avoided that in the first picture scrupulously. We tried to avoid the cliches of the sort of young girl in jeopardy being powerless until the hero steps in to save her, that kind of thing. We'd avoided all of that in the first picture. I knew very well that if they went ahead and made the picture without some kind of overseeing from the creators of the first picture, we would have every cliche in the book thrown into this pot. So I said, okay, well, I'll get involved, but I can't direct because I was writing Cabal and I had another novel coming, executive produce, and I gave them the story. And we picked up the story literally 2 hours after the first one. The movie really rolls. I mean, it's got a lot of forward momentum as a consequence of that, because we're plugging immediately into the panic quotient that finished the first picture. We are, as we speak now, still X-rated. We've been X-rated 5 times by the MPAA, for which fact I suppose I am perversely proud. Obviously, we're doing something right. We have a problem. We still have to get the R rating. I think a lot of things have changed in the last year because we didn't have anything like this problem last year.
Well, talk about that. First of all, who is the MPA and what is your relationship with them? And specifically, what are these changes of the past year? You're going to unavoidably get into American politics.
No, that's very good.
Go at it. No, I'd like you to.
Sure. That's very good because one of the scary things about the MPA is I don't know who they are. I know there's a guy called Richard Hefner who heads up the MPAA. To my knowledge, he isn't interviewed. He doesn't do open debate on his views. The rest of the committee, whoever they are faceless, numberless, possibly even brainless. You have no way of getting access to them.
These are the people who give movies their ratings.
That's right.
AXM, what are the ratings?
Right.
Well, one of the interesting things about the MPAA is it was essentially created by the industry itself. It's a self-regulating body, finally. And the reason it's a self-regulating body is to provide a kind of buffer against prosecution in various states. You can release, as you know, pictures unrated in this country. Several horror movies of late, I mean, I think the Romero pictures were probably released unrated. The trouble is that 70% of the newspapers and magazines will not take advertising for such movies. You cannot get TV advertising for such movies. You can get very limited radio advertising for such movies. So you can release the pictures, but nobody will know that they're there. Secondly, the large circuits of cinemas are very reluctant to take such movies. So you will tend to be playing these shows in out-of-the-way cinemas, and there's an access problem, therefore, for the audience. This would, in any other medium, maybe not be a problem. The fact is that even cheap movies cost a lot of money, vis-a-vis practically any other art form. I blithely say, oh, well, you see, Hellraiser only cost $2 million. And, you know, $2 million is like nothing as far as movies are concerned. You get E.T.'s head for that. But I wouldn't mind getting E.T.'s head kind of thing. But the problem is that you've got to make that money back. And that money is borrowed money. It's borrowed from a bank, and it's costing 10% or 15% to borrow that money. And the mathematics of it work that you want to get that money back pretty soon. There are lots of very, very successful movies that, according to the studios, have never gone into profit. We all know these nightmare stories of, you know, people taking Warner Brothers or Fox or whatever to court and saying, okay, where's my slice of the action? And they are able to bring out the figures that prove that this movie never went into profit. 10 years ago, I think William Friedkin did that with The Exorcist and lost. And if The Exorcist never went into profit, I mean, boy. So I think what we're looking at is a situation where you have to justify spending $2 million of somebody's money. And so built into the contract is that you have to deliver an R-rated picture, because otherwise you don't get that money back. That then becomes a problem, because you've got this picture, which you've spent, maybe in the case of Hellraiser, eight months doing. You've had special effects people, you've had a whole lot of work. Movies are hard work, and they take a lot of care and a lot of effort to make. And if you're going to make them with any kind of sincerity or care, certainly it takes time. And then you send the movie off to the MPAA, and they view it in their inner sanctum. And a pronouncement comes down that your movie is quote-unquote too intense. Make it less intense. Not, we don't like the scene in which, but your movie is too intense.
They can be that vague.
They are that vague.
Because if this were a legal proceeding, a judge would throw... We've had this in this country where a judge would throw out a law saying, this law is too vague. You can't tell the public
this
to be intense. You have to tell them, don't spit on the sidewalk.
Sure, but this isn't legal.
No.
This isn't a legal kind of thing.
But the problem is that there's a point at which the thing becomes, A, obviously an issue of taste, an issue of aesthetics. I mean, to my mind, one of the things about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for instance, is that it is intense. That's why I'm going to see the movie. You can't say to Hooper, don't make your movie intense. There's no movie. What are you going to do with it? And so you're facing the problem that these instructions come out in this very vague way. After a certain point, if they get, you know, sufficiently irritated with you, they begin to get down to cases. And now they're down to cases with us. And it's very interesting. Firstly, I make fantastical movies. I don't make the kind of movies you can go out and emulate. There's weird stuff going down in these movies. And you're not going to get Cenobites out on the streets. So you've got a situation where these fantastical movies are being cut back. And a lot of movies, you know, the Rambo pictures are always a particular bête noire with me, because the Rambo pictures get through pretty much unscathed. And here you have this kind of role model with smoking Uzi between his legs, blasting away anything which is even faintly different from white bread America, and that's that's cool. As far as the MPAA are concerned, that's fine. You get this deeply weird stuff going down, and they immediately say, oh no, it's too intense, it's sick, it's depraved. And they are making, finally, they're making aesthetic judgments. They're making aesthetic judgments under another guise. Mm-hmm. But finally, they're saying, we don't like these kind of movies. Take these kind of movies away. We just don't like them. They're weird. You're weird. You're wacky. Go away. And we had a line from one of them, that one of the guys in the MPAA actually said, well, we don't know what to tell you. You know, the fact is, if you were to do all the things we want you to do to your movie, you wouldn't have a movie. So in a sense, they would like, I think, finally, the bottom line is they would like to edge these movies out of existence. They would like to marginalize them to the point where they're invisible. And obviously, leaving them as X's is one way to marginalize them.
Well, how does, from your own perspective, how does Hellraiser 2 deal intensely, say, as opposed to Hellraiser 1?
Well, I think of the two movies, and I have this on authority of people who've seen both pictures, I think the first movie is probably scarier because it's more claustrophobic. It's claustrophobic because, and that, as a consequence of the fact that we didn't have very much money, we had to shoot it all in one house, and that makes it claustrophobic. The second picture is much more spectacular, much more physically broad, and it's, you know, really great matte shots and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I feel very good from that point of view, very comfortable from that point of view, that it's certainly got the spectacle. What it has got, in addition to the spectacle, is some very strong violence. I mean, some really taboo stuff is going on in the picture. And that's one of the reasons why you make these movies. I mean, you come back to this paradox time and time again, that what they're trying to remove is exactly what you want to put in the picture. Otherwise, why are you doing it? I think the atmosphere has changed in the last year. I genuinely think the atmosphere has changed. I think that this is a much more repressive atmosphere than it was a year ago. We lost about 25, 30 seconds to the first picture. That had the added impact, if you like, of having images which people hadn't even looked at before. This time, they've actually cut out of the picture, or we've had to cut out of the picture, images which they allowed in the first one, but we've reprised as flashbacks. So basically, the same image is being removed. What was acceptable a year ago is not now. And God knows what it's going to be like in a year's time.
When they put it on video, would they probably restore those?
Yeah, they will. We'll have an unrated video. But, you know, that's not really the point. Horror movies are great audience participation pictures. And I love to go to, you know, that's part of the fun of them, going, sure, seeing it in it with an atmosphere of people having a good time. And secondly, the issue, if it's an issue of suppression of information, if you like, it doesn't matter whether it be video or film. The point is that at some point somebody is saying this stuff has a tendency to deprave and corrupt, or whatever the phrase is. In England, to deprave and corrupt is the key phrase. Does the MPAA ever appear on television? Does any representative ever appear?
Insofar as I know, no. Insofar as I know.
Lynch used to be the head.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, he was the man who set it up originally. The reason it was set up, of course, is that if you have self-censorship, then the government doesn't step in.
Right.
And by setting this up, you can create, ostensibly, a rating system where people will know, and therefore you can get away with X-rated.
Sure.
So, I mean, the movie can appear X-rated, but there have been very, very few movies. The original Clockwork Orange, Midnight Cowboy, and Last Tango in Paris, which were X-rated and stayed X-rated. But, you know, in the one hand, on all three cases, you're talking about Academy Award-winning type pictures. You're not talking about, you know, the lower end of the spectrum horror film.
Sure, absolutely. But there's also a whole problem here in terms of the audience. I've been to horror movies in this country and seen really small kids going into R-rated pictures. Now, there's a certain laxity at the box office about letting kids in. I mean, I was sitting in an audience of kids watching RoboCop. Now, to my mind, that's not real healthy. I mean, I'm as liberal as anybody in this room, I would claim. but I think that we are playing into the hands of the repressive elements if we throw up our hands and say, well, everything's cool for everybody. And on one level, I think it's fine to say kids shouldn't be seeing this kind of stuff. I don't write horror fiction. Yeah, let's have this discussion.
Yeah. You trouble me. I can't go head to head with that, but it's kind of worrisome.
Of course it's worrisome, but equally, let's take Last Tango in Paris. I don't really want Last Tango in Paris seen by 8-year-olds. I don't want Hellraiser seen by 8-year-olds. The kind of fiction that I write, simply because of my language, the vocabulary, the syntax, sometimes the subject matter, doesn't attract the kid, the small kid audience. It attracts an audience of maybe 15 and upwards. And I don't mind that. That seems perfectly cool to me. I think it's all a question of emotional contexting. And I think that there's some images which you can hold off from. They're going to get to them eventually anyway. No?
Well, eventually, if they want to, of course they will.
Yeah, such doubt on your face.
Well, yes. But, okay. You and I are both authors.
Right.
And I think both of us would attempt to restrain ourselves from writing certain things in certain contexts and situations. But we don't want the U.S. government or the U.K. government or any other external body telling us you can't write this.
Of course, but let's apply the reality principle for a moment. Let's assume that as I think we must, that there are elements in society who are going to argue from either theological points of view or from political, sociological points of view, that certain kinds of information should be given parameters in terms of where they go.
Yes.
That is going to be the case anyway. It's always going to be the case. So what we have to do, I think, is we have to act as reasonable individuals in full and frank exchanges with these people to say, okay, I understand your anxiety. I understand you don't want 5-year-olds watching Hellraiser. So let's make it work so that Hellraiser uncut can be seen by 16 and over, but you see what I'm saying?
Sure.
And the problem is that the way that cinemas are run in this country, that's not the case. And so you can't actually have that situation. I watch horror movies surrounded by kids.
Yes.
Over and over again. And so quite legitimately, I think quite legitimately, parents say, well, listen, actually, my kids can go see this anytime they like. And they're then saying, so don't show it at all.
But now, throwing this devil's advocate out for a second.
You dressed in white, too.
And me dressed in white. What's going to happen to Hellraiser 1, Hellraiser 2, even Last Tango in Paris, is that they're going to be shown uncut on HBO or Cinemax or Showtime. They're going to pop up in the video stores, and those same kids, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, are going to get them. Now, nobody I know wants to censor videos. What is the difference between going to a movie theater and seeing a Cenobite rip someone's head off and watching it in the privacy of your own home?
Firstly, you say nobody you know wants to censor videos. In England, you go through two censorship bodies, the first for the movie and then again for the video. We lost 25 seconds in the movie of Hellraiser. We lost another 5 seconds in the video. You might be interested to know what 5 seconds. We were talking about this before.
Yes.
There is a scene after the first hammer murder. Julia commits a hammer murder, kills this guy she's brought back from a singles bar. She drops the hammer to the floor and kind of breathes what I had always interpreted as a sigh of relief that she had done this deed. I was called into the offices of the BBFC, the British Board of Film Classification, who pointed out, in fact, that this was a post-orgasmic shudder, and was therefore likely to be a trigger. This is what they're concerned about. This is the word they use over and over again, a trigger for sociopathic behavior. Now, there are certainly such triggers, and I tend to read this research just to try and arm myself against the, the people who are trying to pull the freedom from beneath our feet. One of those triggers is, for instance, the image of blood on breasts. One of the big censorship issues last year was blood on Mickey Rourke's buttocks in Angel Heart. God knows what that was a trigger for.
For a Piles commercial. Medication.
So my sense is that there is a kind of irrationality running through this, which can only be opposed or only be... you can only build a defense against it if you can go into open debate with these people. Mm-hmm. Now, the great thing about the BBFC is that they will go into open debate. I did a whole censorship thing with Wes Craven and Jim Furman, who's the BBFC's head, and myself 2 or 3 months ago at the National Film Theatre in London, and it was a full and frank exchange. I would love to have that full and frank public exchange with the MPAA. It seems to me that if they have points of view, which they clearly do, if they are legitimate points of view, why the hell not voice them? Why the hell not have the conversation? Shouldn't we have these issues out in the air? It seems to me we should.
Sure. Well, a star chamber justice is the worst sort.
Well, absolutely, particularly when you're dealing with something which is so finely balanced on the issue of taste and aesthetics. I mean, the point is, I find the Kerbers aesthetically unpleasing. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the Kerbers are a form of obscenity. They have a light, you know, they tend to deprave and corrupt. My Little Pony has much the same effect on me. Now, I think the Smurfs,
oh, yeah,
Lawrence votes for the Smurfs. So what do? We have a mass Smurfs burning?
Before we get on to Cabal, which I'd like to hit eventually, Dick Lupoff, you said you walked into a video store and saw something called Transmutations.
Well, since we met Clive a year ago, I've been keeping an eye out for these various film projects of his. And there was a poster in my local video store for a movie called Transmutations, which I'd never heard of. I wondered if it was a retitling of Rawhead Rex, which you tell me it's not. But Then what is it?
It's a retitling of another movie. Two movies drove me into the hands of being a director. One was a movie called Underworld. One was a movie called Rawhead Rex. Both of them were made by the same director who could not direct traffic up a one-way street and is not a great friend of mine anymore. He had come to me with saying, you know, would I like to get into the movies, kid? And I had said, sure, that sounds like fun. I constructed a story which became a movie called Underworld, which was a kind of fun idea. It was mobsters versus monsters. It was, you know.
Nice idea.
I thought it was kind of fun.
It was almost as good as Cenobites versus Smurfs.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he made the movie, and I did a screenplay for him. And then he said, well, you know, the trouble is this is a horror movie script. And I said, yeah, well, that's about right, George, because I'm a horror writer, you know. And he said, well, the trouble is we've promised the investors that it will be a rock adventure, quote unquote. And you only realize these things afterwards. So I said, well, I can't help you there because that's not what I write. And he said, well, it's all right because we've got, quote unquote, a tits and car chase man in. This guy they got in who just did exactly that, put car chases in and put in scenes in which girls put on stockings very slowly. And they made the movie. I went on set once and saw what was going on and was kind of appalled, and that was it. They released this movie as Underworld, and then I guess retitled it Transmutations because they sounded, I guess they thought it was more horrific or whatever.
Well, a line under it, from the man who brought you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's, you know, we've all got skeletons in our closet, and that's certainly one of mine. The other one was Rawhead Rex, which was, I had signed a whole bunch of these stories over to these guys, you see. Five of them originally in Rawhead, and they want to make Rawhead Rex first, so I thought, this is when, you know, I've been published like 6 months. Somebody comes along to you, they say, we want to make your stories into movies. You cannot believe your luck, you know? You think this is just going to be the best possible thing in the world, and, you know, they talk a good fight. And also, from the point of view of somebody who's never been involved in the movies just have this incredible glamour. I mean, you just, you know, it's entirely artificial, but when you first start, you think, oh, this is going to be wonderful, we're going to have the best time. So I wrote the screenplay of Rawhead Rex, which was set as the novella was in the middle of England, in the middle of summer, and they filmed it in the middle of Ireland in the coldest February they'd ever had, because for tax loss reasons. Just a terrible picture. So I saw these two pictures. In fact, I've never actually seen Rawhead Rex all the way through. But I saw enough of it to know that this was not a clever idea.
It doesn't pick up.
And my then agent in Los Angeles, on both occasions, I said, Joel, I need to take my name off these movies. He said something which is pure Los Angeles. He said, no such thing as a bad credit, son. He said, no such thing as a bad credit. And in a curious kind of way, he was right. Because when you actually go to studios and they say, well, how many movies have you been involved in? I can now say 4. The fact that 2 of them are complete garbage actually doesn't matter to them. They do play the numbers game. It's very, very strange. You learn all kinds. They just do not care.
I have to disagree a little bit, only in the sense that, again, from the viewpoint of an author. Are you a published author? Oh, yes, I've got 6 books out.
Yeah.
5 of them were absolute garbage, and I'm ashamed of them and wish they would go away and had never happened to start with. 1 of them I like. But you're a published author. Right? It is
yes.
A credential.
Yeah, I agree. But the thing is, I think the general perception is, and I think it's a correct perception, that the movies are a communal art form. And that the French are wrong in many regards. And one of the regards they're wrong in is the auteur theory. No such thing. I really think no such thing. I mean, the trouble is very often the writer is the last person that you remember from a movie. You remember that the costumes are by Adrian or Irene before you remember that who wrote the thing. I do think the movies are made by a whole bunch of individuals, all of whom, if in the ideal world, like in Hellraiser, are pulling in roughly the same direction. Very often they're pulling in completely contrary directions. And in both these cases, in both the case of Transmutations and Rawhead Rex, we had a case where the director, the producer, and the writer were pulling in completely opposite directions. And what you end up with is a camel, you know, designed by committee. And really, to my mind, terrible movies. But there was enough to drive me to go and make Hellraiser, so I have a lot to thank them for. Interestingly, recently I was with a friend of Russell Mulcahy who did Highlander, and Russell had been at dinner with one of the producers of these two movies, Don Hawkins, who had been sweetness and light to me during the period we made making these movies, and revealed in a drunken moment he thought I was quote-unquote a pornographer, and that they'd only made these movies because they thought they were going to make a buck. When they'd come out with Rawhead Rex, they still had 4 more of my stories, and they let the option lapse by about 2 days, and I was on to them like a shot, removed the material from them, so that was going to be the end of that saga. Otherwise we could have looked forward to another 4 Rawhead Rexes.
No, but no more.
No more, enough
and
already.
No more Underworlds.
And no more, no, none of that.
We'll get to Cabal. First I want to ask you about another hardback that came out.
Yeah.
Books of Blood came out in hardback from, I guess, Putnam.
Putnam, yes, sure.
Ace Putnam. That had come out. Now, Books of Blood in England was 6 volumes that came out as 1 volume. Is that correct?
No, they came out as 6 different books. And volumes 1, 2, and 3 came out in the Berkeley editions and did very well. And Putnam said, well, why don't we put these in a hardback edition, a very handsome hardback edition, I think. I did 3 little illustrations for it. I think it's got a great cover. I really like the cover. It's just a nice thing to have. What they also did was they took from volume 6 of the Books of Blood a little kind of rounding off story, a little epilogue story, and put it at the end of this edition so that you know, it's like a little edition of the Books of Blood. Volume 4 of the Books of Blood became The Inhuman Condition here in America. Volume 5 became In the Flesh, and volume 6 constitutes 4 stories along with the novel Cabal, in the new book, Cabal. Segue into Cabal.
I was going to ask you if that was volume 6 of Books of Blood.
So now everything with Cabal, everything from the Books of Blood will have been published in America at last.
But in totally whacked out, insane.
In totally whacked out
right.
Order. And, you know, one of the reasons, Dick, was that simply that people, what happened was that people thought that this stuff wouldn't go. This stuff was originally bought by people who didn't have the slightest faith in it. And then it did go, it did sell. And this is why the hardback came after the paperback. Because they thought, we'll put out these paperbacks, we'll put some pretty cheesy covers on them, which I think they did, which is still on them. In fact, the Books of Blood covers, I think, in America are not great. And they put out these covers with Halloween masks on, and they thought, they won't do anything. And I think they're now in their 3rd or 4th printing. Hence the hardback coming out afterwards, you know. Then Simon Schuster came along and picked up the next 3 Books of Blood, but clearly couldn't continue the title. change the titles. It's all very confusing.
Lawrence Davidson from Cody's Books.
As a bookseller, one of the problems that I have is convincing people when they come in that In the Flesh indeed is part of Books of Blood. And they say, well, why isn't it called Books of Blood? You're wrong. And they don't want to hear. And it's quite frustrating. Of course, I convince them, they walk out with it anyway, sure. And then they come back and sure. go, oh, you were right, you know. Yeah. It's just so annoying that the publishers won't give you the kind of support that I think you deserve.
You know, one of the things is that there is this Byzantine infighting going on in publishing. Dick knows this, I'm sure. Publishing is actually a very small community. Everybody either knows each other or has slept with each other or whatever else. And the people move to and fro between the companies with monotonous regularity.
A lot, constantly.
Editors and publicists and so on. And there are a lot of enemies made. There's a lot of infighting going on. So when Simon & Schuster come along and buy up the Satan Books of Blood, they say, well, we're not going to use the same title because Berkeley did that and we hate Berkeley. You see, and so they go away and they do that. It's difficult for me too because I'm also having to constantly say, as you are, to your customers, I'm having to say to fans, look, this is volume 4, this is volume 5, and now volume 6. I think it'll come clear now that we finally got all 6 volumes out, but we've added to this new book an entirely new spanner in the works, a short novel which didn't exist in any English edition, and this is the first edition, the first American edition of this, the first world edition of this, I should say.
It's not that short a novel either. It could have appeared by itself. It's over 200 pages.
That's right. In England, it will appear by itself, which will confuse the English. No, that's right, and it's the first of 3 books about this this character or the situation.
The Calgary werewolves or whatever they are.
That's right. What I've done here, what I've tried to do is do something I've been aiming towards or moving towards through the writing I've been doing over the last 5 years. That is, finally, all the humans, all but 2 or 3 of the humans are the most despicable bastards. And all the monsters are kind of sexy and interesting and funny. It's actually the flip side of Aliens. Aliens is about kicking monster ass, you know, Rambet in space, you know. It's about going in there and destroying what is different, which is a common human hobby. I'm trying to make that work in a very weird kind of way here by having a character, Boone, at the beginning of the book, who is human and alive and very unhappy and ends up monstrous and dead at the end of the book and very happy. And moving on through to 2 more books, The Inhuman Adventure is Just Beginning. What was that Star Trek, right? The yes. Human Adventure is Just Beginning, yes. Right? The Subhuman Adventure is Just Beginning.
Great, great.
So that's what we're moving towards.
Why did you set it up in Canada?
One of the things I've been keen to do is to prove that these kind of stories needn't be sort of located in single places. I'd done stuff in Yugoslavia, Berlin, New York, the Midwest. Weave World is in Liverpool. I've wanted always to just find lots of different places to do it. Do these stories, find different environments and atmospheres. I want to avoid the gothic cliche that you really need the house on the hill, the mist rising from the swamp or whatever. But I need to go to those places before I can write about them. Last year, I guess just after I saw you, I did a 3-week or 4-week tour of Canada and spent some time in Calgary and in North Alberta, which I thought was just great. It's a very beautiful part of the country and very empty. It has this kind of wonderful, obviously scenic glamour, and there aren't many people. I thought you could hide an army in this place. Nobody would ever know. And I wanted to do this story for a while, and this seemed to be just absolutely the ideal place to set it. So it's just a question of having the having the experience first. The one that I haven't yet attempted, I attempted earlier in the year, I went to Tokyo. I want to write about Tokyo, but I'm really nervous because that whole atmosphere is so difficult to describe. So difficult. And I want to get that absolutely right. I like the idea of finding finding locations, you know, as you travel around. The new book, The Art, which follows up, comes up next year, is set in Ventura County and in Los Angeles, because that's an area I have now got to know.
Is that the sequel to this? No.
No, it's a big fantasy novel about two evolved, infinitely evolved human beings fighting for the dream life of America. It's a big fantasy book.
And it's called
The Art.
The Art. And when's it supposed to come out?
It comes out, I guess, if I can finish it, it'll come out September of next year.
September of
89.
That sounds wonderful. But the last time you visited us, about a year ago,
yeah,
you were just in the midst of a tour doing a lot of radio talk shows,
sure.
And you told us that you'd had some really bizarre experiences with people calling up and accusing you of being Satan personified.
Sure.
Right? Anything further on that front? I found that absolutely fascinating.
Oh, yeah, it's been quite a lot. I was on Larry King last week, and somebody called up and said that I don't quite understand the metaphysics of this, but my soul was already simmering in a little broth down there. It's a little frustrating when you go on Larry King, because if something happens like that, Larry is so good and so combative, he basically takes over, and he just loves to just go in there and have that kind of conversation. I was in Edmonds in Washington State day before yesterday, and a small bookstore doing a signing, and they had threats. Beforehand, there'd been calls through that I was the Antichrist and all this kind of thing. Again, on Larry King, I think somebody called up and said that they were burning my books in Milwaukee.
having a beer bash at the same time.
Don't you just love it? So, drowning my books in Milwaukee. That's something that just doesn't really come up in England. This kind of whole religious fervor, which there really is no equivalent. A couple of good Christian folk tried to set up a TV, you know, kind of evangelical station in England. Nobody had the least patience for it. I mean, it was we threw a whole bunch of people out of the country for thinking that way.
What do you plan on? Now, you mentioned The Art. What about the sequel to Cabal?
That will come, I guess, after The Art. I just finished my next... with The Art, I will have delivered my next contract. I will have fulfilled my contract with Simon Schuster, so we will now have to work out whatever the next contract is going to be. But before the next book, I will write and direct the movie of Cabal, which will be called Nightbreed, in which we start shooting in February. And I've done my company has done a deal with the people who are behind Dead Ringers, the David Cronenberg picture, a wonderful company called Morgan Creek. We've done a deal where we're going to make three movies.
Do they have a cast on that yet?
We are casting at the moment, and we're a little way off. We just need to cast two or three of the principals, because they all undergo transformations of various kinds. The special effects men back in Pinewood are already working on that. We have a massive monster count. We have about 60 monsters in the picture. And so the special effects people have been at work for 2 months already, and we don't start shooting for another four. There's going to be things slithering, shambling, and sloping through this movie on every other frame. We're going to have a good time with it.
So it doesn't sound like there are any short stories in the works in the near future.
Here's a problem. Getting short stories into the hands of readers is actually quite tough. Readers just don't like short stories. I am pretty much anomalous now in having made my career, if you like, on short stories. Ray Bradbury obviously did it way, way back in the 50s, in the early 50s. But novels are what sell. I mean, I go to my publishers and I say, I'd like to do some more short stories. And they say, yeah, well, a couple more novels first. I mean, yeah. Is this you two decades?
Constantly.
Yeah.
Constantly.
There's a basic reluctance. Particularly genre fiction, particularly my kind of, or our kind of genre fiction, science fiction, fantasy fiction, horror fiction, there's a reluctance to accept or to publish short fiction, which I regret, because I think there's a lot of ideas out there which I have going around my head, which I don't want to turn into novels, and I don't want to turn into movies. And one of the things I loathe, and there's a lot of these novels out there at the moment, are novels that you think, God, this would have been a great short story. And there are narratives which lend themselves absolutely to that form. And I regret the absence of those formats.
There are a fair number of, small to fair number of markets around magazines and anthologies in which you can place these stories. But it's extremely hard to get a publisher to do a volume of the collected short stories of
Absolutely. Though, I mean, there's been a couple of anthologies. The Dark Descent, David Hartwell's collection, which I think is sensational. Absolutely extraordinary. And I think Primeval, which Doug Winter did, has got some nice stuff in it too. So, I mean, there are certainly examples. But you're right. I mean, going to a publisher and saying, look, I'm going to spend the next year providing you with a volume of short stories, they go pale and say, no, don't do this to us.
Right.
And so that's the problem. The problem is a marketing problem as much as anything else.
It's just a shame because everybody's so fond of your short stories.
Yeah, I love them too, but, you know, in terms of the numbers of books sold, which is fine, you know, I'm not a cheap author to hire in now. If they're going to buy a book from me, it's going to cost them some money, and they need to be able to make that money back. And making money back from short stories happens, but it happens over a long period. How often do you see a collection of short stories on the bestseller list? Very, very, very seldom.
Doesn't happen.
And I don't think that that's changing. I think it's actually getting worse. I think the novels, very often you're getting these massive novels, which are underfunded in terms of their ideas. You know, you think, why is this 600 pages long? You know, why have I trudged all the way through this novel to get to this? And that's, I think, a consequence of the fact that there aren't these outlets. You're right, there are magazine outlets, but even those, you know, I mean, what is that? There's very little.
That's been my problem with Stephen King over the past few years. It just seems that these 600-page books would have been great 150-page books.
Well, I'm a great fan of Misery because it's a shorter book. Not because it's a shorter book, but because it's exactly the right length it should be. Absolutely. But it's audience expectations. Well, you know, I mean, they're about to release, I think, The Stand with another 200 pages in. The 200 pages were taken out. Obviously, it's the magnum opus. Obviously, it's the book which makes the broadest possible statement of Steve's books. It's tough. I mean, then you get something like Silence of the Lambs coming out, the Thomas Harris book, which is sensational, very sharp, very economic, and you just race through it, and it's chilling every page. And so people are doing it, just that I think there are ideas out there which I would just like to turn into 20 pages of prose.
Speaking of Stephen King, one of the things I wanted to ask you was how you feel about that blurb.
Well, actually, for the first time, I asked my publishers not to use the blurb on the cover of Weave World for two reasons. First, it's not a horror novel, it's a fantasy novel, and I didn't want to sort of, you know, lead readers astray. And second, I think it's getting unfair on Steve. I mean, you know, Steve made this remark. It was extremely generous of him to make that remark. But there's a kind of almost a level where it's almost exploitative to just continue to use a series of Stephen King quotes. I just think it's unfair.
You have a question about one of the short stories.
In the new book, there's a story called How Spoilers Breed, which is easily one of the most powerful stories I've read in quite some time. There's a scene where dust motes start cutting up your protagonist, and it's quite obvious you're having a good time doing this. And
yes.
What I wanted to ask you is, how much do you enjoy sticking it to your protagonist that way?
Well, this is a particularly vengeful story, okay? How Spoilers Bleed. The spoilers in this particular case are the ravages not just of large amounts of Amazon rainforest, but of a particular tribe in the Amazon, who they are walking roughshod over, who in fact they actually murder. Finally, they actually eradicate a tribe. We're talking about genocide. And if I can work up sufficient hatred for a character, I can get a lot of jollies out of watching him taken apart at the seams. this is a somewhat anomalous story in the sense that the villains of this story really have no redeeming features whatsoever. Shadwell in Weaveworld, for instance, has moments of ambiguity, moral ambiguity. No way with these guys. These guys, Locke and Cherrick and Stumpf, are just like bad guys. And it's very seldom that I actually draw the lines so carefully between the white hats and the black hats. But here was a story which really got to me. I mean, it was sometimes you see something. Maybe other horror writers write out of anger. Once in a while I write out of anger. I certainly wrote that out of anger. And I wanted to write something about these guys who were just using up a whole people, a whole tribe. And the world comes to get them, you know? The world comes to get them, not in the sense of people with guns blowing them away, but in the minutiae. What happens is they're cursed and they become increasingly sensitive to the world. It's the Republican's nightmare. you are a sort of enforced sensitivity, you know, the kind of thing which just makes you more and more responsive to pain, which an entire community in this country and certainly in my country have managed to put behind them. and what I was writing about was that sort of mentality being fucked over. And I have to say, that kind of mentality being, let's try that again, shall we?
Thank you.
Can you get away with that? You can't.
No.
What I was writing about was that kind of mentality getting its just desserts. But the satisfaction that comes when you write that kind of thing is entirely down to how badly you feel towards the character. And in that case, yes, I enjoyed myself.
In the beginning of the story, you're talking about these guys in the jungle, and they're more or less explorer types, and it becomes very clear that they're like dark shadow images of like Indiana Jones. Because for a second there, I thought that's where you were going to... I said, this is kind of odd for Clive to be writing about pith helmet
Right. Well, there's a whole 19th century literature, isn't there, of the explorer as hero, you know, who, if you actually look back on some of those activities, the Rider Haggard kind of stuff, Burroughs did some stuff, or Edgar Rice as opposed to Bill, though actually Bill did a few explorations of his own, but they were quite different. The kind of bringer of lucidity and the stealer of icons, you know. We do tend to overlook the fact that Indiana Jones is actually going and stealing the religious icons of cultures in which he has no part, he has no place or right to be. That is a motif of a lot of 19th century adventure novels. And in fact, most of the, many of the great works housed in the British Museum are now being, the countries involved are trying to claim them back. Because in the 19th century, a lot of British guys with pith helmets on came in and said, listen, we give you beads, we take your temple, or we take your sacred god, or whatever. I mean, the Greeks are trying to get the Parthenon back, the Elgin marbles, and are failing. The Brits are saying, no, we got these when you were vulnerable and didn't know what you had. You sure as hell aren't going to get them back now.
What was the name of that new movie that you're working on?
The new movie will be called Nightbreed, and it will be out in August of 89.
Clive Barker's film Hellraiser 2 was followed by Hellraiser 3. There were also several video games, and eventually a remake in 2022, in which Clive is listed as a producer. Several of his other stories were later adapted for film and television. His book, The Art, was eventually published as the two-volume Books of the Art. The Great and Secret Show, which is often considered his finest work, and Everville. Nightbreed, the film, came out in 1989 and flopped, so no sequels were made. While no books have been published since 2014, he was interviewed in 2024, saying that he was working on several projects that are still forthcoming. IMDb notes that a Nightbreed television series is in the works. You've been listening to an interview with legendary horror and fantasy novelist Clive Barker, recorded at Dark Carnival Bookstore October 21st, 1988. My co-hosts were Richard A. Lupoff and Lawrence Davidson. Until next time, I'm Richard Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.